Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. Following President Obama's remarks yesterday that Ronald Reagan would not survive in today's Republican primary, we will begin with Princeton historian Sean Wilentz, the author of The Age of Reagan, A History 1974 to 2008, and discuss the current Republican Party and its likely standard-bearer Mitt Romney, as well as who might be his running mate. Then we will speak about the Ryan budget, which the president, in tying it to Mitt Romney, described as cruel social Darwinism. Thomas Ferguson, a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts Boston, joins us to examine Mitt Romney's economic priorities reflected in the Ryan budget that he has embraced. Then finally, we'll be joined by James Kwok, the co-author with Simon Johnson of the new book White House Burning, The Founding Fathers, Our National Debt, and Why It Matters to You. We will expose the myths surrounding deficits and debts and what needs to be done to fix our economy if and when political gridlock ends and an adult discussion begins. Joining us now is Sean Wilentz, the Sidney and Ruth Lapidus Professor of History at Princeton University, where he's taught since 1979. He's a contributing editor at The New Republic, and his books include The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, The Age of Reagan, A History, 1974 to 2008, and his latest, Bob Dylan in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sean Wilentz.
Great to be back, Ian.
And what did you make of the president's remarks where he suggested that Ronald Reagan could not survive in today's Republican primary?
Well, he's right. to the extent that, you know, Reagan was a much more pragmatic, even though Reagan had some pretty far-out right-wing notions that he regularly broadcast and regularly talked about, he was a political animal, and he would never have gone as far as, say, Rick Santorum or even Gingrich this time around in some of the things they've been talking about.
But why did the religious right give Ronald Reagan such blind fealty? Because, I was always mystified at the time. Here he is running against a Southern lay preacher who is demonstrably religious and demonstrably of the Bible Belt.
Right.
And yet this divorced Hollywood actor became the standard bearer of family values.
Yeah, well, what happened was that what we think of as the evangelical right was more right than it was religious in a sense. I mean, when Falwell and the others put together their coalition or joined the coalition that Paul Weyrich put together behind Reagan in 1978, 79, around the moral majority, you know, they were objecting not so much to the place of religion in American life as to very specific political things that Carter was not behind. I mean, Carter believed in the separation of church and state. A lot of these guys, like Falwell, were offended by how much the Democratic Party and liberalism in general had, marginalized religion, had taken, you know, prayer out of school, that sort of thing. And Reagan was willing to play lip service to all of that. Abortion was, you know, was a key issue. Reagan was a right to lifer, so he said. So they had no place else to go. Reagan was their boy. Certainly wasn't going to be Carter, despite the fact that Carter, as you say, was a very pious evangelical Christian, and Ronald Reagan, let us say, was not.
Well, but now it's become a competition of who's the most pious.
Well, who's the most pious, but also of a particular kind of piety. In the case of Santorum, who I think is the most interesting, I mean, Santorum comes out of a particular corner of the Roman Catholic Church, which actually most Roman Catholics don't identify with, which showed up in the voting. He did not get the Catholic vote. He got the evangelical vote. He comes out of a sector of the Catholic Church that's aligned with an organization in part called Opus Dei. Some people call it the Da Vinci Code wing of the Catholic Church. That's to be snide about it. But the fact is, it's a very, very conservative, almost pre-Vatican II vision of the Catholic Church, which takes a very strong line, for example, against contraception. So this is something that most American Roman Catholics don't buy into, but Rick Santorum insists on it. So it's a much more conservative, much more, almost reactionary kind of religiosity that's coming out, not just intensity of piety.
Sure. Well, I don't remember when Reagan was running against George W. Bush ever having, I mean, George H.W. Bush, right. ever having to say in the debate how much he devotes his life to the Lord Jesus.
Yeah, right.
His son did that, and in many of these debates, all of the Republicans, except for with it, and even Ron Paul, who's clearly, I don't think, a Bible basher, they all sort of mouthed their fealty and their to the Lord. So,
well, it's been a process, you know. I mean, this mm-hmm. has been going on. This drift has been going on ever since Reagan.
And, right. But now we have this amazing paradox, Sean Wilentz, that a Mormon is now going to be the standard bearer of the Republican Party.
I love America.
So go figure. I mean,
Well, I mean, yes, and a Mormon's going to be getting the votes, it seems, of a lot of evangelical Christians who suspect that his religion is really a cult. No, it's very odd. The way that's worked out. Romney's a serious Mormon. People ought to, you know, take account of that, and maybe even read the Book of Mormon, let alone see the show, The Book of Mormon, but actually read the thing.
The first few pages are incredibly violent. I mean, it's a strange.
I will say no more than intelligent and informed voters maybe ought to read the Book of Mormon.
Right.
They're going to be thinking about a serious Mormon. But that's not to say, look, I mean, religious tests are not part of American life, American political life. We believe in the separation of church and state. And, you know, Romney's done nothing to suggest that he's going to be a Mormon as president. Although it would be interesting to press him on that issue. It would be interesting for him to have to give the speech, for example, that John F. Kennedy gave in 1960 talking about...
Sure, but he's repudiated that speech, Sean Wilentz. He didn't so much repudiated it, but he said that he felt, and he was pandering obviously to the evangelicals, that secularism was on the rise and that religion needed to be defended.
Then he ought to be pressed about his own beliefs.
Yeah.
If he's going to take a different line than what Kennedy did, obviously.
Well, Kennedy opened the door unquestionably for him, but he has not walked through it. I'm pretty sure of that. You know.
Well, let's find out. I mean, I know Santorum actually genuinely repeated. He said it made him vomit or something.
Right, he did. He said,
It more or less killed him as far as a lot of American Catholics were concerned.
Right.
But it'd be interesting to see where he comes out once he's gotten the nomination, you know, once he starts having to pander quite so much to the religious right.
Well, it is, some of the questions, I think, are quite legitimate in the sense that it's there's no analogy between being a Mormon bishop and a Catholic bishop, but he has had he's been a huge tither and very active in the Mormon church. And I talked to the two guys from the Boston Globe who've written the biography on him, and they say that he's, you know, just like Al Gore was completely wooden, except in person, he was quite self-effacing and quite funny.
Right.
Apparently, the wooden Romney is very different in his Mormon milieu, and that is where he really, you know, is relaxed and is himself. So he's a man that's very much a product of his religion and his church and the culture of his church.
Well, there's no question about that he takes his Mormonism very seriously. He is, you know, a bishop. He's important. But again, the question comes down to, you know, what line is he going to take? And it's a very tricky one for all the reasons you started with, Ian. I mean, the Republican Party has moved so far to the right on these questions of religion in American life, and not just intensity of religion, but the kind of religion you're talking about, that it is a question that's appropriate, you know, that should appropriately be put to Romney once he gets the nomination.
Well, you know, the people on the Republican side, and I think a big chunk of the party, are perfectly happy to call the President of the United States a Muslim. So it seems appropriate that somebody could at least ask this man a question about his religion and.
Well, I think that, the Republican Party has it. I mean, that's nothing that Mitt Romney would be saying, so it's going to be hard to nail that to him.
Yeah, but I'm saying if it's fair game to you know, on one side, I'm not suggesting that people accuse Romney of being a polygamist or anything, but at least ask a couple of intelligent questions.
Intelligent questions, absolutely. I mean, you know, you don't want to, you know, I don't believe in doing the same thing to the right that the craziest people on the right do to us. But by the same token, there are legitimate questions to be asked.
What do you think, then, Romney will do to sort of, you know, it seems like he's dodged the religious bullet. We've talked about that, and, and that's pretty pretty surprising in itself. I think Santorum has finished two or three weeks now before the next one, and I think he'll be forgotten by then. What did you make of the role, though, of Gingrich? I'm in the minority in wondering about whether that guy was ever serious in the beginning, whether he's just angling for a job and for some lucrative contracts. He's never taken the race seriously. Apparently spends more time in expensive restaurants than he does on the campaign trail. And his main backer, this one billionaire who basically financed him, is now financing Romney. And you could make the case that Adelson was making a better investment in Romney by investing in Gingrich, because Gingrich split the anti-Romney vote.
Well, there's a lot of you know, questions right there. First of all, regarding Gingrich, I have long ago stopped trying to figure out what drives Newt Gingrich. I mean, he's in some ways politically on a different level than the rest of us mere mortals. I can't quite figure out why he was doing what he was doing. In part, it's vanity. In part, it was hoping, you know, that the brass ring might just, you know, come into his grasp. You know, you never know. You know, this politics is a very uncertain game. But I think that actually, recently, I mean, I think that while he was splitting the Romney vote from one angle, he wanted to, he was also causing Romney difficulty. And I think that, in fact, his backer was trying to make life difficult for Romney. And then finally, you know, it just got to be too much. I mean, Gingrich was just not going to happen. Santorum, though, Santorum, it depends on what Santorum wants to do. I mean, Santorum can do a lot even if he doesn't get the nomination. And you talked, Ian, about angling for positions. I would look at Santorum more than at Gingrich. And I'll give you an example from Romney's history for a sec. In 1968, George Romney had wanted to be president of the United States. He didn't get it. Richard Nixon got the nomination. But if you remember, George Romney was in Nixon's cabinet, and there's a reason behind that. And the reason behind that was because he threatened to go on the floor of the Republican Convention in Miami in 1968. He threatened to open up a big floor fight about a plank in the platform, about an open housing plank, a liberal plank, which Nixon didn't want to see happen because it would rip apart the party. And so Romney ended up in the cabinet. Santorum could do exactly the same thing. He has enough delegates now to do threaten exactly the same thing, if he wanted to do so, if he wanted to press his own, you know, very dogmatic point of view across. If he wanted to get power, if he was angling for a position, he could still do that. So,
well, we don't have a minister.
There's a lot more going on in politics than we might imagine.
But as far as I know, we don't have a cabinet position of Minister of Religious Affairs.
So. I don't think he'd want that. I think I can think of a lot of other ones that he'd like even better. I mean, imagine him as you know, in charge of the of American education. Yikes.
Homeschooling for all. Who do you think Romney might pick for a VP? Because he's obviously got some healing to do, and he's got some positioning to do there. And one of the more interesting suggestions came from a very liberal Democrat who worked in the White House, Van Jones, who suggested on the Sunday talk shows that Condoleezza Rice would be a very astute choice on Romney's part to have her as his VP.
Be interesting because she's, you know, a black woman running. It would be out of sorts for the Republican Party, playing against type. There's a problem with Condi Rice, of only because if you've noticed, even though the Bush family and indeed Karl Rove is very much behind Mitt Romney, you haven't seen many photo ops between even George H.W. when he supported Romney the other day, did so without pictures around. And George W.'s been out of it. There's still a lingering feeling that anything associated with the Bush administration is not a good idea. And, you know, Condi Rice was obviously very much a part of the Bush administration. She'd have to answer to all of the things that the Bush administration was about. That would be a mark against her you know, being the choice. You know, as imaginative as it might seem from a demographic point of view and even from a political point of view. The other thing, though, is that she doesn't add much in terms of reaching out to the other wing of the other wings of the party, nor does she add much geographically. I mean, she's not going to carry any state with her. Unlike the man who was being talked about earlier, the young Marco Rubio from Florida. Now, turns out that Rubio was a Mormon for a week and a half sometime in his life. That might be a mark against him. You know, people might think there are two Mormons running for president, running the ticket. But again, you know, he would be an interesting choice because he is from Florida, and Florida is a real battleground state. You know, Condi doesn't you know.
Sure. Well, do you think that Romney, you know, you'd think if just talking in terms, I'm speaking to you, Sean Wilentz, from across the street from Universal Studios here in Hollywood. So I'm talking in a Hollywood sense of casting. You know, when you got a boring, stiff guy at the head of the ticket, you would think logically you'd want to have somebody to liven up the ticket, which is exactly what McCain did with Palin. And perhaps he rused the day he did that. Yeah. Do you think that he's going to have to make a bold choice, as in fact Sarah Palin suggested?
Well, I think that, you know, I mean, the story of McCain and Sarah Palin is a complicated one, which had to do with the internal dynamics of the right wing of the Republican Party. And basically, you know, I mean, McCain didn't get the people that he wanted to. So the right wing, basically, and when I say the right wing, I mean, you know, Bill Kristol and the Weekly Standard crowd basically nixed that. They said that's not going to happen, and they, in fact, came up with Palin. You know, so McCain, it wasn't so much that he was, you know, going for a Hail Mary or a good universal casting option. He was just, he had no choice, really, in the end. I think that Romney has more choice. You know, they're out of power now. I think that they're going to be looking for, you know, someone who is, he's not going to be pushed into something. First of all, you don't want the vice presidential candidate to upstage the presidential candidate.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say, yeah.
You know, it can be a danger.
So who's duller than Romney? Boy, that's going to be a hard one.
Yeah, well, Romney, you know, you and I think he's dull. There are plenty of Americans, you know, people are voting for him, Republicans are voting for him, who think of him as, you know, people kind of like dull Americans in some way. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's true. It's not like it used to be. You have to have certain kinds of qualities, and certainly Obama is very deft at just those kinds of personal qualities. So he would outshine Romney in that respect, but. I don't know. People have underestimated Mitt Romney a lot, and I wouldn't want to fall into that trap. In fact, I think it's going to be a very, very tough campaign when he gets the nomination, in fact. I think that the president, I think the president will be reelected, but it's not going to be an easy fight.
Well, I certainly don't, to quote George W. Bush, underestimate him. No, I think you're absolutely right, Sean Wilentz, and I thank you for joining us.
Well, it was a pleasure to be here again, Ian. See you again soon.
Good. Again, I've been speaking with Sean Wilentz, who's the Sidney and Ruth Lapidus Professor of History at Princeton University, where he's taught since 1979. He's a contributing editor at The New Republic, and his books include The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, The Age of Reagan, A History 1974 to 2008, and his latest, Bob Dylan in America. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about the Ryan budget.
My name, it ain't nothing. My age, it means less. The country I come from is called the Midwest. I was taught and brought up there, the laws to abide, and that the land that I live in has God on its side. Don't do as I do.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Thomas Ferguson, a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and a senior fellow of the Roosevelt Institute. He is a member of the advisory board for George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking, a contributing editor for The Nation, and the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Ferguson.
Hi there.
And the president yesterday made a fairly fiery speech where he tied Romney, who now appears pretty much the new standard bearer for the Republican presidency, tied him as much as he could to Ryan and Ryan's budget. And today Mitt Romney sort of struck back and tried to he didn't repudiate what the president said. But he tried to sort of deflect it by saying the president came here yesterday and railed against arguments no one is making and criticizing policies no one is proposing. That is not the case, obviously. But the president did make a pretty stinging remark yesterday, which was that the Ryan budget makes Gingrich's contract with America look like the New Deal. So you know
it's proof that somebody finally in the Obama administration can write a funny line. it stands out precisely for that. These folks have not, despite all the noise about how Obama makes great speeches, in fact, they haven't been powerful or persuasive now for actually literally many years.
Well, a couple of other things that he said that did make the headlines, or at least they're out there in terms of buzzwords. He referred to the Ryan budget as sort of cruel social Darwinism that would impose a radical vision on the country. Do you think that the country understands that or could be persuaded? And nobody's going to read the damn thing, but it sounds like most of the consensus is that it's fraudulent, it's not realistic, there's no revenue raising.
Yeah, the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities had put out an admirable little two-graph thing which suggests that like 62% of the cuts in the Ryan budget come from low-income programs. You know, you just got to ask. Yeah, I think people can sort of get that. I can't believe I'm saying this, Ian, and I, you know, may yet look ridiculous, but I actually think that the Republicans are overreaching, and they're sort of overplaying a bad hand to the point that, you know, I have to say, I'm not trying to make an excuse for the Obama administration. If you ask me, these guys, in normal circumstances, would not deserve re-election. I think they'd been, you know, that terrible. They had no reason to step up the war in Afghanistan, but they did it. They did the half-size fiscal stimulus. They were way too friendly to the banks, et cetera. But, you know, the Republicans have come on so outrageously, so just super centered on the, in effect, the 1%, if I may adopt that vocabulary, that you know, the Democrats are in the end going to look, I think, better for most folks than that. It's not the world's greatest set of choices, but you know, I think it's going to be a pretty clear one. I've been doing a little research on the sort of what's going on in the Republican primary, and I have to tell you, you know, the striking thing about that. Even yesterday, I understand that the press is doing its best to anoint Romney, and I agree he's going to win it. I've said that I was on record on that for 6 weeks ago or so, you know, in print, that all his cash would finally just beat down his opponents. But even yesterday, he did not do that well. You know, he only got about 49% of the vote in Maryland, and he didn't do much better than Santorum in Wisconsin. It's a really pathetic and weak performance. And I actually think, I've been looking at the data here. I'm about to publish this in Aldernet with my colleague Walter Dean Burnham, probably the greatest voting analyst in the United States for many years. I mean, what you got here is the you can see a huge disparity in the Republicans in the states, in rich states, Romney seems to do pretty well. He does poorly in poor states, and you know, he gets the rich in all those states. There's always the income disparity. This is somewhat disguised by a very troubling fact. The New York Times, in its hard copy, is actually ceasing to report the income breakdowns in the Republican primary. They did it again today. I can hardly believe they do that. That is just I used to be the assistant, the guy that took the New York Times poll for ages. I was his assistant in Princeton. I mean, he knew how to do polls. That type of presentation, I think, would not have been acceptable 15 or 20 years ago. You need to present the income breakdowns when you, in any poll you're running, and it wasn't there this morning in my copy of the Times. So you don't see the sort of lopsided, you hear all this stuff about Tea Party likes or dislikes and things like that, but you don't see the income breakdowns there. And they're lopped. Romney is clearly winning on the super affluent votes in the Republican Party, and he's losing even that party's base. I think he's going to be a very weak candidate in the fall. I have thought all along, because of the president's vulnerability on the economic issues, that he'd be weak. It's looking to me like Romney is just so obviously allied with the 1%. I mean, the guy's just a ham-handed way they say it over and over again. I think this is really going to hurt him.
So, Thomas Ferguson, do you think the Republican Party is so much in the pocket of the 1% that they don't, they're not worried about this, or they don't recognize it? I mean,
if you look at the way people, even guys like Rubio and Pataki, when you look at their endorsements of Romney, they go way out of their way to say, well, he's not that strong a candidate. And, they thought other people would enter, but, and so they're all coming around. No, I think they're taking, this guy is the lesser of a set of evils, frankly, even to many Republicans. I think people can see the death's head here, which is why I'm not quite totally persuaded that Romney has the nomination sewed up, not because he's not going to be way ahead in delegates, and I expect him to win most of the major primaries and stuff, but I have a feeling he's going to look like a loser very definitively as they go into that. And, that may yet make people think about the switch in time. But the
Republicans are so hungry to win, and they hate Obama in a very disturbing and irrational way. It seems to me they're just going to rally around whoever it is and just go for broke.
I think it will be hard in the matchups. I mean, as polls, right now you don't see the Gallup matchups and others sort of dominating the headlines. As we go toward the Republican convention, you'll see those will become more prominent. And, right now, Romney's behind in just about every state that matters. Just as a comment on your lead in there, on the Ryan budget, it was, of course, not Obama, as you know. I mean, I understand this. It was Romney who sort of first more or less endorsed the Ryan budget as he kind of backhandedly endorsed the Right to Work campaign in Wisconsin. The Republican Wisconsin governor there was pushing. I mean, this guy's gone out of his way to sort of take extreme positions. And, the Etch-a-Sketch business works up to a point. But I think he may now be treading, even I, who have generally thought that you could get away with almost anything in American politics, I think Romney is now sort of walking out toward the pillars of Hercules of the American electoral imagination. He may be out there in places where folks haven't tried to go, and he may not return.
So here he is embracing the Ryan budget, which he refers to as marvelous, Romney. And apparently Ryan makes his congressional staff read Ayn Rand. And so he apparently is quite a disciple of Ayn Rand's bizarre ideas. But the budget, the thing that the president seized on, and I imagine he's going to be able to use this in the election, is that millionaires all get $150,000 back. That's their average annual tax cut.
Tax cut.
Yeah.
Tax cut for the super rich.
Yeah, but the way the president referred to this giant, yet another tax cut for the rich. He said the president said the $150,000 that the millionaires will get back from the Ryan budget in terms of a tax cut would represent a year's worth of prescription drugs coverage for a senior citizen, a new school computer lab, a new school computer lab, plus a year of medical care for a returning veteran, plus a medical research grant for chronic disease, plus a year's salary for a firefighter or police officer, plus a tax credit to make a year of college more affordable, plus a year's worth of financial aid. So in framing it in that way, I think maybe that might get the attention of the average American as much as they pay attention.
No, I think so too. Look, I've always thought that a Democratic president, if he or she would choose to make the case, could blow the Republicans away. You know, my point about money in politics and sort of my investment approach is, unfortunately, these guys get attached to the cash and they won't do it. But now Obama's job is, you know, he could join the unemployed if he weren't careful. I think he will certainly, it looks to me like they will run a sharp enough campaign that they will pick up on enough differences. I think the Republicans have real trouble with this, you know, because no matter how many times all the newspapers, especially, go out of their way to try to make you think the opposite, the fact is the bulk of the population really doesn't want Medicare or Social Security touched. They do not want giant tax breaks for the rich. They want taxes to rise. That's a powerful political sentiment out there. You know, we saw how powerful it was last year when the sort of Occupy Wall Street business surfaced. And, you know, it's still pretty early in the spring. Mm. I think we may yet see more sort of protest bubbling up. And life here is becoming kind of unlivable. And there is it's a little crazy because, I mean, you know, if, for example, the U.S. got involved in a war with Iran, that would destroy the U.S. budget. It would just absolutely devastate it. And the whole thing would be, I mean, and you got all kinds of stuff up in the air, sort of like soap bubbles or something, that the bulk of the media is afraid to puncture, won't even touch, or keeps telling you it doesn't matter or the facts are just the other. I think the population is really unhappy. The real conclusion you should draw from the Republican primaries, you know, is that Romney has trouble even now winning, you know, 50% of the Republican vote. If Obama had a Democratic challenger that was, you know, reasonably plausible, I don't doubt that he'd be having trouble. You really have an angry population here, and mm-hmm. I think that people are way underestimating how much dislike there is for both parties.
Well, I agree that Tom Ferguson, there's an angry population populace out there, and I think on the Republican side they're angry and they're taking out their venom on Obama, you know, being a Muslim and with a fake birth certificate and all that stuff. On the Democratic side, if you will, and this ties into your book, Golden Rule: The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems, is that there's a wide and widening gap that's been widening over the decades between the Democratic voters and the Democratic politicians and the Democratic establishment.
Absolutely.
I mean,
absolutely.
Bill Clinton wooed Wall Street. And move the, and we know that the Capitol Hill is all about money. There, yeah. Whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, all you do spend all day is making raising money from lobbyists and having fundraisers. And so, as long as and that's why it explains why both Clintons and
money-driven parties.
Yeah, exactly.
And if I may just. Yeah. don't miss the message in the Republican Party, which is that a huge chunk of the base disdains their own nominee. I mean, I am quite struck yesterday. I mean, I'm looking at incomplete returns, so somebody could finally. But I don't think in either Maryland or Wisconsin, Romney quite got over 50%. He got real close when I last looked in Maryland. But, I mean, this is. And this is really, this is like moving through mud to this nomination. I know he said to have it in bag, and I think he's got it in the bag, though, as I say. He may look so weak limping into that thing that folks may actually want to start thinking about changing him. But the Republican Party base clearly disdains Romney, and though I know the press says overwhelmingly it's the evangelical religion business, it's plainly social class, too. There is very plainly in the Republican base an economic basis of folks there. I actually think that's one of the big stories in this campaign. It's I think the conditions that you got a Republican Party together are disappearing because, frankly, the population that was sort of had been incorporated there, especially the evangelical chunk, they weren't rich. They're now hurting badly, and it's not obvious that you can repair all those jobs out there, and that stuff counts too. Not just about God.
Well, but do you think Obama could reverse this growing fissure between the Democratic voters and the Democratic Party establishment, the politicians and the establishment who have courted Wall Street and big money and lobbyists to stay abreast of the Republicans? That explains the disconnect between the policies and programs that the Democrats get through the Congress and yep. the wishes of the people. The people, these people are not responding to their base. Yep. So what if Obama were to turn on the bankers, who, by the way, have turned on him,
careful. I know people say that. I don't think an analysis of the Democratic National Committee funding will fully support that.
Uh huh. Well then,
he's produced the numbers, but I will. One has to be extremely careful here. I heard this all through 2009 and 10 when I went back and did the numbers. What I discovered was, at least on the investment banking side of it, the Democrats were still out ahead of the Republicans. Mm. Commercial banking was a different story. I hear you, but and I'd say it's just amazing, right? That it's like history gives Obama a second chance. I think, however, that they're pretty firmly money oriented up there. I think they will not take advantage of it, but they don't have to take much advantage of it, I think, to blow Romney away.
I see. So you don't think it'll even be necessary for him to move in a more populist direction?
I think that looks off the bat. Look, when the Republicans move like they have, almost don't have to say anything except I'm not a Republican and hope everybody won't notice.
I see. Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Thomas Ferguson.
Yep. It's a pleasure. Have a good one.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Ferguson, a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. He's a member of the advisory board of George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking, a contributing editor to The Nation, and the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with James Quirk about his new book, White House Burning.
Crazy for cash, but I ain't got none. Oh, I'm just
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing, and that, believe it or not, was Leonard Cohen with his song Mountain of Debt, which is our way of introducing our next guest, Dr. James Kwok, a professor of at the University of Connecticut School of Law and a fellow at the Harvard Law School Program on Corporate Governance. He's the co-author, along with Simon Johnson, of the popular economics blog BaselineScenario.com, and he and Simon Johnson are also co-authors of the bestseller 13 Bankers, The Wall Street Takeover, and The Next Financial Crisis. And his new book just out is White House Burning, The Founding Fathers, Our National Debt, and Why It Matters to You. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Kwok.
Thanks very much for having me back.
And the book that you and Simon Johnson have done, White House Burning, The Founding Fathers, Our National Debt, and Why It Matters, is an attempt to expose the myths surrounding deficits and debts, and it also provides a prescription of what needs to be done to fix our economy. But how do you fix the political gridlock? How do you get the gridlock to end and an adult discussion to begin?
Yeah, well, you had to start me off with the toughest question, didn't you? that is the most important question. I think that there is no easy answer. I think that the best answer I can give you, and perhaps one of the reasons why we most important reasons why we wrote the book, is that I do believe that at the end of the day, the political, in a sense, the politicians we have are the ones we deserve. So the politicians are elected by the ordinary people, by people like you and me. And if politicians say nonsensical things, it's because we allow them to get away with it. And I think that one problem with discussions of deficits and the national debt has been that this is a complicated and oftentimes a seemingly boring topic, and people don't understand quite how it affects them in their daily lives. So just to give you one example about this, if you poll people, a lot of people think the national debt is a problem. It generally comes in number two to jobs. So jobs and unemployment is number one, then deficits and the debt are number two. And then if you ask people what we should do, they say we should cut spending. And then if you ask them, well, should we cut Medicare, they say no. Should we cut Social Security, they say no. Should we cut Medicaid, they say no. Should we cut national defense, they say no. And this is because it's a combination of people not understanding what's in the federal budget, for which you can't blame people. It's a pretty technical topic. And it's also a combination of that and the fact that our politicians do not talk straight with the American people. So this is a very long way of saying that if people become better educated and take an interest in these ideas, like a lot of people did in 2009, 2010, about our financial system, then we have a better chance of having a serious policy debate. Now, one thing I've not mentioned in all of this is the huge and growing influence of money in politics, which makes this more difficult. But that's essentially the only way I think we can have a serious discussion.
But it seems to me that people in their minds, and I'm pretty sure that they've also been encouraged to think this way, equate the national debt to their own personal finances. Isn't that one of the problems?
I think that is a very common way of thinking about the national debt, and it has the benefit of being clear and immediate and concrete. And as many economists will tell you, it's in many ways it's fundamentally wrong. So I think the two most important ways it's wrong: one, we saw during the past few years, which is that during a recession, for an ordinary family, when your income goes down, you generally need to cut spending, to try to make ends meet, and that's generally a good thing, because running up debt in many cases is not a good thing to do. With the federal government in a recession, I think a majority of economists, I wouldn't say all of them, but a majority think that the government should do the opposite. It should borrow money, it should spend money in order to keep the economy going. So that's one instance where the comparison to the family budget doesn't work. The other instance, which is perhaps more important for our book, is that the dynamics of when a country is no longer able to borrow money are very different from the dynamics of when a family is not able to borrow money. So families can go bankrupt if they can't meet their debts. The United States government is a much more complicated thing. I think we saw, last summer, during the debt ceiling crisis, or slightly just after the debt ceiling crisis, S&P downgraded the Treasury Department, and interest rates fell, which means that more and more people wanted to buy U.S. government debt. Now, one of the things we say in our book is that this probably can't last forever. But certainly for in the environment we're in right now, the amount of debt that the United States is taking on has not yet shown up in a reduction in our ability to borrow. But as I said, we think that this is not something we should count on for the next 30 or 50 years.
Well, a lot of it is caught up, I think, particularly you mentioned the threatened to shut down the government. Happened a couple of times, as a matter of fact, over the debt ceiling. And a lot of that is driven by the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party, and to some extent the Ron Paul people as well. And they have the advantage of living in a very theoretical world. In many ways, I would wish that there could be an alternative universe to show what a country like the United States would be like without a government.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Although I would say, actually, we don't necessarily need an alternative universe. I mean, there are actually countries that have very low taxes and very low government services. A lot of them are in Africa, and a lot of them are very, very poor because you don't have government services, so the only people who can afford private security are the very rich. You don't have roads, so people can't bring their products to market. You don't have a stable currency, so business essentially breaks down. And that is the extreme. I mean, that is what happens when you don't have government services. Now, just getting back to the Tea Party for a second, I do think that the Tea Party is a multifaceted phenomenon, let's say. And I do think that, on the one hand, you have a lot of people who very genuinely believe that we should have much smaller government and much lower taxes. And I would say that is actually a kind of a coherent position. I think at the same time, you have some other people, especially among the political operatives and the funders, who are much more cynical. And essentially, their ploy is to cut taxes at any possible opportunity, and with the full realization that this is never going to be matched by lower spending. And we saw that during the Bush administration. We just saw that with Paul Ryan's budget. He wants to slash everything, but he wants to increase defense spending.
And cut $150,000 tax on all the wealthy. So, James Kwok, again, professor at the University of Connecticut School of Law and a fellow at the Harvard Law School Program on Corporate Governance. He's a co-author, along with Simon Johnson, of the popular economics blog BaselineScenario.com. And he and Simon Johnson are co-authors of the bestseller 13 Bankers, The Wall Street Takeover, and The Next Financial Crisis. And they have this new book, which we're talking about now, just out, White House Burning, The Founding Fathers, Our National Debt, and Why It Matters to You. And the book points out, of course, that a lot of people, 44% of Social Security recipients say they do not use a government program, as do 40% of Medicare recipients and 43% of unemployment benefit recipients. So you have this sort of immaculate economy here that has where invisible socialism, if you will, and it leads me to ask. I mean, obviously, it's an example of enormous ignorance and economic illiteracy. But it also leads me to the main question, which I wish the debate was framed around, instead of most of what we've been talking about, which I don't think are particularly insightful or helpful debates about the debt and the deficits. One would hope the American taxpayer was thinking about, and after all, Americans are pretty pragmatic and practical people, you would think that people in this country would be really focused upon what they get for their tax money, what government services they get, and the quality of the government services they get, as opposed to their obsession with the fact that they're overtaxed, which they are not by international standards.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, to take the last point you said, if you look at advanced industrial countries in the world, we are one of the lowest taxed advanced industrial countries in the world. If you look at federal and state and local taxes put together, lower than every country in Western Europe. There are a couple Asian countries that pay lower taxes than we do. Going back to your point, I think Americans' relationship with the government is actually quite complicated, but I think a lot of politicians have simplified it beyond recognition. So to say what I mean by that, you're absolutely right. I mean, we pay taxes, we get services. And these days, most of what the government spends comes directly back to people. So two-thirds of all government spending is in the category that's called payments for individuals. So that includes Social Security checks. It includes Medicare reimbursements. It includes Medicaid reimbursements. Includes salaries and so on. So the idea that, but instead, I think that a lot of people have the image that most of their taxes go to faceless government bureaucrats who do things they don't understand. And what we hear about is we hear about specific examples when things go wrong, like Solyndra. Solyndra got an enormous amount of press, right? So, because there was a government loan that went bad, and people think essentially the government is this corrupt, incompetent thing. Now, the federal government is not, you know, all branches of it are not the most efficient organization in the world. I will grant you that. But when it comes down to the question of what are you getting or where are your taxes going, you know, the EPA, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, those are all rounding errors. The real money is in Social Security first, Medicare second, and then National Defense is third. And I'm sorry, actually National Defense is before Medicare now, but Medicare is growing faster. But I think what's happened is that people, on the one hand, they know, if you ask them about it, they like Medicare. They say they want to keep Medicare the way it is. But at the same time, they have a very abstract notion of the government as this wasteful, corrupt thing that gobbles up their taxes and doesn't give them anything back. And that image, I think, has been fostered, you know, for decades, especially particularly by conservatives by anti-government, anti-tax conservatives, who have played up this image of the wasteful government, and moved the spotlight away from the programs that people do like. But last thing I wanted to say on that point is, you know, when push comes to shove, the Ryan budget essentially drastically reshapes Medicare and then cuts, you know, most spending on government services down to virtually nothing over the next few decades. And the real question is this actually possible? Because, you know, Republicans have been talking about cutting back these social insurance programs for decades. And when push comes to shove, I'm not sure even if they win the White House, they win the Senate, they get 60 votes in the Senate. Well, they're not going to get 60 votes. But even if they win the White House and they get the Senate this fall, it'll be a very interesting question to see if they follow through on these plans, because I'm not sure they have the stomach essentially to roll back the government to the 1920s, and I'm not sure the American people will stand for it.
Well, it's not as if they haven't tried. I mean, George W. Bush he got reelected. He said, "I got political capital," and he spent all of his political capital on tilting at windmills, trying to privatize Social Security, and imagine what would have happened to Social Security if it had been privatized, and what happened in 2008 on Wall Street.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think that's a very good point you bring up. It's interesting to note that Social Security is the one thing that the current crop of Republicans will not touch. So Paul Ryan, I believe in this year's budget, essentially does not touch Social Security. And I think that's partly because of the experience of George W. Bush. And so now the heavy guns are aimed at Medicare and essentially, you know, on the premise, basically on the premise that we cannot afford to sustain Medicare for the next few decades. So,
I know we've only got a couple of minutes left here.
Sure.
I just wanted to get an understanding of you know, a lot of young Americans who believe that they'll never see their Social Security and they don't have to pay in for something they don't think they're going to get. This belief system is encouraged by Ron Paul, and they are flocking to libertarianism. And it seems to me that is a demonstrable example of the failure of the Democrats to communicate economic reality.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that part of it is that the libertarian slogans are easier to communicate than what I would say is, the principled defense of social insurance programs. You know, and the way I would try to put it, and I know I'm not a political consultant or a messaging expert, but the way I would put it is that Social Security and Medicare, you know, are often framed as transfers from the young to the rich, from the young to the elderly. that's not how I look at them. I look at them as a way for all of us to share risks across society. Because if you think about it, when you're 21 years old, you're entering the workforce. You don't know how long you're going to work. You don't know how much money you're going to make. You don't know how healthy you're going to be. You don't know how much healthcare inflation there's going to be. You don't know if you're going to be disabled, if your parents are going to end up in a nursing home, and so on. There are all these things you can't predict. And I think that the only institution that can protect you from these risks in the long term or help you manage these risks is the federal government, because no private insurance company can insure you against something that's going to happen 50 years from now.
Well,
and I think that... Yeah.
I'm sorry, just saying, I'm afraid to say we've run out of time, Dr. James Quirk. But I thank you for joining us and hope we can have a follow-up conversation.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. James Quirk, who's professor at the University of Connecticut School of Law and a fellow at the Harvard Law School Program on Corporate Governance. He is a co-author, along with Simon Johnson, of the popular economics blog BaselineScenario.com. His latest book is White House Burning, The Founding Fathers, Our National Debt, and Why It Matters to You. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with Princeton historian Sean Wilentz, who's written about Ronald Reagan. And yesterday, the president said Ronald Reagan would not survive in today's Republican primary. We talked about how far the party had moved to the right and how amazing it is that this largely religious evangelical party has accepted, apparently, perhaps grudgingly, the Mormon Mitt Romney. Then the question becomes, who does this dull guy get as his VP? Obviously, you can't get somebody that's more interesting than you are, that you'll be upstaged. And I suggest it's going to be pretty hard to find somebody that's duller than Romney. One of the suggestions made by Van Jones, of all people, was Condoleezza Rice, which we looked into. Then I spoke with Tom Ferguson about the Ryan budget. And, of course, it is an obscenity. And it is more social Darwinism, and $150,000 for tax break for the already super rich had all the tax breaks in the world. And we talked about what that would buy in terms of social programs and whether the president's going to run as a populist, because there's always been this disconnect between the Democratic base and the Democratic politicians and their funders. Little wonder people feel they're sold out, because the Obamas and the Clintons have to respond to the people who give them money and not to the people who vote for them, and thus the disconnect. So he thinks that it's going to be a tough race in spite of what a terrible candidate Romney is. And then finally, I spoke with James Quirk, the co-author with Simon Johnson of the new book, White House Burning, The Founding Fathers, Our National Debt, and Why It Matters to You. And we discussed all of the myths surrounding deficits and debts and why it is that the American taxpayer is distracted by this lie that they pay too much taxes and don't really concentrate on not how much taxes you pay, but what you get back for your taxes in terms of government services. The rest of the civilized world understands that, but we have yet to figure that one out.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Lady dressed in white with the man she loved, standing along the side of the pickup truck. A shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right. Another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305.